It is 7:31, time once again for Community Forum, and we're very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning Harvey Baker and Laird Schaub, who are both board members of the nonprofit Fellowship of Intentional Community, and we're going to be talking about that very thing, intentional communities. Harvey and Laird, thank you very much for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Mike.
Let's begin. If you could tell us, give us a definition of intentional communities, and maybe tell us how you both got involved in this issue.
Well, a number of years ago, we were struggling with the idea of a definition of intentional communities, and we decided that description is a better word than definition. Definition tends to cut away people and groups that somebody thinks aren't really an intentional community, whereas that group may think it is, whereas description has a fuzzier boundary, which is what we need in the intentional communities arena, because it's very fuzzy as to whether a group is intentional or not, and the intention is what creates the idea of intentional community. So we say generally an intentional community is a group of people who share common values and who want to put those values into practice with other people of like mind. It typically includes a residential component or shared property that where they can focus the place of to reinforce the sense of community, but it there are non-residential intentional communities, but the key is the intention to live out the values that they share in this group.
The values can be a wide range of things. They can be spiritual, they can be environmental, political, economic, social, or any combination of the above. And as far as the fellowship is concerned, it's up as long as you're upfront about what you're doing and straightforward, then we let people sort themselves out, and we don't promote one kind of community over another. The only two exceptions we make as an organization are that we don't advocate for groups that embrace violent practices as part of what they're trying to do, or interfere in any way with members' rights to leave a group if they're dissatisfied and want to get out. So with those two exceptions, as long as people are straightforward about what they're doing, then it's fine with us, and then we let people make their own choices.
Right.
Now, you asked about our personal story about how we got to community, and I'll tell mine first, and then Harvey can follow. In my college years, it went through what I considered a big growth spurt and a maturation process of exploration of, like, who was I, and how did I get along with other people, and I was in an environment of what I called stimulation and support in college. It was a community of people who shared the same SAT scores, so that wasn't one that I really chose. I didn't even think of it as community at the time, but dormitory living had an intensity about it that was very stimulating. And then when I left it and went into the job world for a couple of years, I worked for the federal government, and I felt like my life slowed down in a way. I thought, well, I lost something that was really valuable, and community seemed like a potential answer to that. Get together first with the people that have similar values and let your work life follow from that rather than follow the work opportunity and then try to recreate friends in place following work. So essentially, I got back together with people from college years, 2 years after leaving it, and then we started a community together. And I'm 32 years later, I'm still there because I found what I was looking for, which I have this great environment of people who will both support me and stimulate me to examine my life and then create a base of operation in the world.
And there are some similarities between Laird's and my path to community. I lived with people in both college and graduate school, and then I went through a period of pretty extreme isolation. I worked in Italy for a year, barely speaking Italian, and then worked in Mexico for a year, both in academic positions. And while in Mexico, I was reading about some of the more together intentional communities that were coming out of the movement in the mid to late 60s, and was interested in that, maybe in part or reinforced by my isolation in these foreign cultures. I decided that having learned that a person of my status in a foreign country, and especially a third world country, had no real power to affect the course of that country, I could deal with individuals and teach them mathematics, which was my academic area, but I couldn't really have an influence on the government or even on the culture that was being so overwhelmed by the U.S. and corporate culture. And so I decided that it would be better to be in this country where, even though I only had one voice, at least I had a voice in the general trend that, that was shaping the world. And I wanted to do that with other people. I didn't want to be as isolated as I was in Mexico. When I came back to this country, I got a job in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, and moved into a group house that was affiliated with a community of people that had come together around worker-controlled collective businesses, very egalitarian businesses. And so we, when we realized we were a community, and that that was something that was not easy to create or maintain in our culture, we decided to move it to a more permanent location. So we bought land in southern Tennessee and started building houses and developing an economic base to support ourselves over the years. And that was about the same time that Laird and his friends were creating their community. We bought our land in 1974.
And give us a sense for how many intentional communities there are, let's say, here in the U.S. and worldwide.
The fellowship takes as one of its prime missions collecting and making available as accurate and up-to-date information as we can about who's doing what and where they are. When we first came on the scene, nobody knew about us, and I think the responses we got to our invitation to give us information was modest. Over the years, we've established ourselves as a reputable ecumenical group, and the responses have gotten better. In addition, we're the growth of the 20 years in which this organization has existed means we started before the information age or the internet and so on, and now 95% of our contacts happen electronically, and so we make our information available both in a book form, a directory of intentional communities, and then also an online version of this. We have different numbers in the book version and the online version. The online version is more robust. We have, for U.S. and Canada together, 1,250 communities listed, which doesn't mean that's all there are. It just means those are the ones that are interested in having information about themselves posted in a public forum, which will invite contact from strangers. So we know that the numbers are larger than that. We suspect it's more like 3,000. You have to take into account that the definition of intentional, that who selects, who is an intentional community, that's a self-defined process. We don't bless people and say, you're in and you're out. They choose themselves. And when does a group house become an intentional community is a very individual choice. So there's a soft edge about who to count, and we think that there are many, many groups out there that would consider themselves an intentional community, but they're happy with what they've got. They're just interested in it to create a good life for the people there, and they really don't want contact from strangers, so they don't publicize themselves or make it known that they're there except through word of mouth. We never hear about them. So the numbers have been growing. When we first started doing our directory, we had a book that listed, I think it was about 400 intentional communities in 1990, and the numbers that we're able to list go up every time we do a new book. Now, we were talking before we went on air, Mike, that the Pacific Northwest is a hot spot for intentional communities. I was doing numbers just yesterday on our website, and just taking into account Washington, Oregon, and British Columbia in the states and the provinces, 12% of our listings on the online directory come from those three places. So that shows you that geography is a real concentration of interest in intentional community right here.
Do you have any sense for why there's more happening in this area?
I think basically this is a thing that's done by very liberal groups for the most part, people that are well-educated and liberal, and you're going to have, this is obviously a politically liberal area in many ways. This is what Ernest Kallenbach called Ecotopia in his fictional book from many years ago, and so that we're in a zone that has always been viewed as one that's been experimental and curious about these things. There's other spots in the country. You can go down the coast all the way on the West Coast, and you'll find a lot of concentration of intentional communities. There's a lot in New England. There's another hot spot in Central Virginia, North Carolina. There's different pockets. This is just one of them.
And talk a little bit about the focus of your organization, what you do, and maybe if you could weave in there, do you tend to find people are more interested in joining a pre-existing intentional community, or are they interested in kind of starting their own?
we are basically a clearinghouse for information about intentional communities. Both we create bridges between intentional communities that exist already. We help people who want to form a community both with information from our headquarters and also connecting with communities that they maybe have a similar vision with, so that they can find mechanisms to help themselves create this community and keep it going. As Laird mentioned, we put out a directory of intentional communities. We also publish a magazine, Communities Magazine, that attempts to create articles about what are the realities of community rather than being just, we have this community and everything is great. So we talk about both the good things and the difficult things about living in a community. That can provide people with an idea of what they're getting into. They can learn what they need to learn from other people's challenges, and then they can find those tools both help working through the Intentional Communities movement, through the Fellowship for Intentional Community, and also from the communities that they've contacted through us.
There's some other products that the Fellowship puts out in addition to the directory and the magazine. A big thing today, as I mentioned earlier, is website presence. And so I want to mention our URL, which is www.ic.org. And we have that'll give you links to all of the different online services, including our directory, which is interactive and searchable database. In addition to that, another big thing we do is events. And in fact, there's one going on right now. We're opened last night, continue today, and into Sunday afternoon. We are hosting the Art of Community Northwest, Co-Opportunities for Sustainability. It's located on the campus of Bastyr University, which is in the middle of St. Edward State Park on the east shore of Lake Washington. And there's still opportunities for people who are interested in hearing this program to come and join us while we're still in session. We have a big day today, and Harvey and I will be leaving the studio and going right over there, and I'm doing three workshops today and a benefit auction tonight. So that's a great opportunity for people to get information, meet a lot of people who are living in communities. They can talk to them, find out what their personal experiences are, get a taste for what we do, and find out a lot in all a short period of time, and they can do it without leaving the city they live in.
There's another area that the Fellowship is moving into over the last few years. It's a new thrust for us, and that is that we feel like the ability to operate collectively, to cooperate, to collaborate in our culture, people don't learn this naturally. And so over the last 20 to 50 years, intentional communities have been experimental laboratories in how people can learn to cooperate and work together. And even though we still, individual groups fall on their faces sometimes and challenge each other with very difficult things, we feel like we have learned some very basic and fundamental lessons about how people can collaborate more effectively and get more out of what they're doing together with less trauma. So we call this creating community intentionally wherever you are, or even guerrilla community building, where the other people in the group may not say, oh, we're building community together, but if you have that perspective, you can help that group collaborate more effectively, and nobody else need know. I mean, your perspective can be a seed in that group that can blossom into a more effective, more cohesive group. And so this is part of what we're also talking about at our event over the weekend.
As the Fellowship considers what ways it can be of use in the culture, how can we provide a social service, how can we be a base of positive social change, it's occurred to us that probably the numbers of people who are willing to make the step to own property jointly with others and live that closely is never going to be large. We think maybe in the most liberal definitions, there might be 100,000 people in the United States that live in some form of intentional community. And that's with a fairly broad circle. But 100,000 people in a country of 3 billion is a very small number, and the influence or the opportunities to even find out about it may be very limited. At the same time we say that, and we're still committed to providing information about that particular opportunity, we realize that the hunger for a greater sense of belonging and connection in our culture, that is the desire for more community, a sense of community in one's life, is epidemic. I mean, almost everybody will tell you today, if you ask them, do they have as much community in their life now as they did growing up, will say no, that there's been a deterioration, that the social fabric and connection is weaker now, the sense of fear and alienation is greater. And we're trying to provide the tools out of the experience of intentional community by which people can create that in their lives without necessarily owning property with others. You also asked about the are people more interested in starting or joining? We kind of glided past that. I want to come back to that question, Mike. Definitely more people are looking to join than start. However, there's a significant slice of people that have the dream of starting their own. And what we tell people now is that, for the most part, is there's only one real legitimate reason to try to start a community rather than join one, and that's because you can't not do it. So for some people, that is that it's just burning in them to create this thing, and they will not be satisfied joining somebody else's effort. They've got it in them to do it. And it's very hard to start one. It's much easier to join something that's already proven successful in some sense. And you'll have to make your way. You might think, oh, gee, I'll have to compromise what's the perfect community for me if I join somebody else rather than start my own, because I can make it in to be exactly what I want. The truth is, though, that there's so many challenges to successfully starting a community, and you're going to have to make so many choices and compromises along the way that you don't even know, that we strongly urge people to first try to satisfy yourself by joining something that's already established. However, both happen, and there's always new starts. To a large extent, it's like starting new restaurants, though. Most communities don't make it to their second birthday. It's hard work.
Well, I was thinking in terms of people that, after they check out your resources, do you know of examples of people within like the inner city that have homes near each other that could essentially start an intentional community?
There are there's a national organization, and I can't pull the name out of my head right now, but it is actually promoting neighborhood cohesiveness by encouraging people to create a common space in their backyards, tearing down the fences, creating pathways to connect the houses in the back area without having to do it for everybody in the block.
It's called Neighbor Nets.
Yeah,
Harvey. And I think the main proponent of it is somebody in the Seattle area named Habib Rose, who's at our conference this weekend.
So there are ways that people can restructure their neighborhood with cooperation from just a few houses that can then start spreading into that neighborhood.
Have you seen a growth, or perhaps maybe of late, an increase in the people that are interested in intentional communities, somewhat due to both our political landscape as well as just the general conditions we're looking at, planet-wide, with, let's say, global warming?
We've scratched our heads the entire history of the organization to try to figure out what are the major indicators of when interest in intentional community rises and falls, and it's very hard to predict. I mean, there's theories that in good economic times, people have the flexibility to try out new things because they've got some latitude in their lives, versus the theory that when economic times are hard, people reach out for different and maybe more radical solutions because they feel the crunch of things not working. I don't know which is true. What I can tell you is what the flow of interest ebbs and flows, and we are in the midst of a relatively prolonged plateau of interest in community right now. It started around 1990. Our organization got together in the mid 80s, and there was the prior surge of interest was 65 to 75. And then there was a 15-year period that was a lower time of interest, and now we're in a much higher one. At the same time we say that, though, there was nobody doing what the fellowship did 20 years ago, which is collect this information and make it available, both in a book form. That book didn't exist in the same way 20 years ago. So once that's in play, we start to affect the data, because now there's more people you can contact to get information from. On top of that, we're in an electronic age. It's so much easier for people to post information and receive it. It's so hard to uniformly compare. I mean, how is this surge different than the others? We get more contacts, but it's easier to make contacts. In any event, there are a lot of people interested, and we continually get a flow of requests, and that keeps us going.
I think another important point here is that people who are working on some of these things you mentioned, like peak oil, environmental degradation, they are starting to look for more holistic responses to the problems that face us, and those holistic responses almost invariably include community and connection between people. because the alienation and the individuality tend to make every person make that situation worse. The fact that people drive in their individual car to their work creates problems in the oil area that carpooling and public transportation and other community-based modes of transportation would lessen. And so what we find is that even people working on, you know, who in the past have been very focused on their one particular form of change are finding that when they start looking holistically, they include community and cooperation as one of the core values of how to move forward in a positive way. There's been a conference that this, I think it's a couple weeks from now, the 23rd, 24th of September, there's a conference in Yellow Springs. It'll be the third conference on peak oil and community, where community is being proposed as one of the key elements in the solution of what are we going to do about peak oil, because community can increase our efficiency in utilizing our resources. So the people who are looking at these challenges, when they're looking for a solution, community comes in as one of the key components.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking about with, again, the example of a neighborhood, because I'm thinking about, you know, my particular situation with, and just simple solutions towards, let's say, things like, I mean, I have a car, but I drive it maybe a couple times a week. I mean, it's ridiculous for, like, mm-hmm. everybody on the mm-hmm. block to have a car, mm-hmm. you know, and things like, you know, lawnmowers or whatever. Mm-hmm. There's mm-hmm. so many things that if we were okay. sharing, and it seems like the intentional communities, the work that you've done could be models that we can look at for solutions there.
Yeah, yeah.
In my community, we're an income-sharing community, which means all the money earned by individuals gets put into one pool and then provides for everybody's needs. That's only about 12-13% of the movement is organized economically that way. So we're an exception. However, it's also we can achieve the largest benefits of sharing that way. We have one washing machine for the whole community. It's a really good one, and it's used all the time, but we only need one, and that kind of thing. So car sharing, you'll see, even aside from the intentional communities, you look at your situation, Mike, where you're in the neighborhood, there's a rapid rise right now in the interest in car co-ops, for example, where people realize they need access to a car, but they don't need to run a car every day. They don't really even need to own a car. And if you think about, I mean, Seattle's a great place to bring home to people the impact of everybody owning their own car. The traffic scene here is a nightmare. I mean, thank God this program was Saturday morning so we could get into the station from where we're staying. So if people were sharing cars in neighborhoods and stuff like that, there just wouldn't be near the problems that way, and much less oil would be used. And you still pretty much have the access to the vehicle when you need it. You have to plan ahead a little bit. You have to talk to your neighbors. And we live in a very individualistic culture that success is measured by your control of material goods in some ways. And like, I've made it because I have my own home. And I mean, you think about the dream of a chicken in every pot. The dream was more than that. It was that you own the pot and you own the chicken. And it's like, we don't have to do that. What we need to do is make sure you got access to a pot and that there's enough chicken to go around.
So you are both in town because there is a conference happening this weekend. Can you talk a little bit about that?
As we said earlier in the program, it's at Bastyr University, which is on the east side of Lake Washington in the Inglewood area. We're trying to create a conference that's not just people lecturing at you, much more participatory, many different modes of learning, including just, you know, a wall of information that people have put up on little pieces of paper about who they are, what they're looking for, what they have to offer. So we're looking to create connections among people in this region, to give them tools they can take home and use, but also to find other people that they can do those things with. It's much easier to create those incremental changes in your life that create new patterns that work better for you if you have some support, rather than people saying, oh, that stuff died in the 60s. And so if you connect with other people, you can find ways to collaborate with the folks who are interested, and those there you create the seed that starts to flower in your area when more people learn about it and see it working.
There's also a lot of local or regional people that are going to be there to talk about specific sustainability initiatives and opportunities right here in the Pacific Northwest, not just national opportunities. The keynote speakers include Lisa Fitzhugh from Seattle and Arts Corps. We've got Mark Lakeman from City Repair in Portland, and Vicki Robin from the Conversation Cafe that's here in Seattle, I believe. And then David Corton, an author who just put out the book The Great Turning, is going to speak on Sunday. So there's different people here going to be talking not just about intentional community, but the connections of how to build community, and it's important in a culture that works and is an essential ingredient in a sustainable world.
And again, you have both been doing this for quite a while, so you obviously see it as a sustainable thing. And any recommendations you'd have to people who are interested in diving in?
Certainly the first thing I would do would be to either look at the website www.ic.org or contact the fellowship. Do you remember the phone number?
Yes, we have an 800 number. You can get in touch with us to find out about our products and services and learn more about what interests you. It's 800-995-8342.
We're in the business of helping people create more community in their lives, and it's foolish to reinvent the wheel over and over again. When we started our communities, there was very little information available, and we were flying blind. And a lot of the people that were flying blind in those days crashed. Our communities were fortunate enough, and we were fortunate enough to luck into or have the right. We were fortunate enough that our community succeeded, and we can sit here talking about them today. But there are many that crashed, and we don't see that that's a useful form of human energy, useful utilization of it. We would rather that people succeed in getting more community in their lives. And so, in my opinion, even if you have a burning desire to create your own community, start learning what other people have done, visit other communities to see what works and what doesn't for them, so that your vision is more accessible to you, your ideals can be lived out by you in your life.
And I think there's a big piece of advice is if you really want to find out about this, don't just read about it, actually go and arrange a visit. Almost all these communities that we have in our directory welcome visitors and have an easy way to go and visit for a day, a weekend, or a week. And you'll find that your physical experience of being a community will inform you additionally to what you're reading and your mental process is. Community is a whole body experience, not just something you do in your head.
All right. Well, I want to thank you both very much for coming in this morning.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Mike.
Happy to be here.
It's a pleasure.
We have just been talking with Harvey Baker and Laird Schaub, both with our board members of the nonprofit Fellowship for Intentional Community. And again, you can find out more about their work at their website, www.ic.org.